This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Later in the program, we'll talk about a story that another U.S. service member is being investigated for sexually abusing subordinates. This after a survey showed that service members reported tens of thousands of sexual assaults last year alone. We'll speak with three women in the beauty shop who know a lot about this subject to talk about why this problem persists and what can be done about it. But first, we want to tackle some of the other stories this week that have some critics asking whether this government, this administration, has abused its authority. This week, it has been confirmed that the Department of Justice secretly obtained phone records from the Associated Press to investigate the leak of sensitive information. It's also been confirmed that the IRS gave special scrutiny to Tea Party groups in a manner that IRS officials themselves say was inappropriate, and that the president called outrageous, if true. Needless to say, conservatives and Republican lawmakers are outraged, but there are critics on both sides of the aisle, so we've called two analysts from both sides of the aisle to talk more about this. Ron Christie is with us. He's a Republican strategist and former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. Glad to have you back with us, Ron.
Always nice to see you, Michelle.
Also with us, Corey Elins. He's a former advisor to the Obama administration and the senior vice president of Vox Global. Corey, welcome back to you. Thank you so much for joining us
once again.
Thank
you, Michelle.
So we want to start with a story about the AP phone records. Attorney General Eric Holder held a press conference yesterday explaining why the Justice Department started looking into the AP. This is what he had to say.
I've been a prosecutor since 1976, and I have to say that this is among, if not the most serious, it is within the top two or three most serious leaks that I've ever seen. It put the American people at risk, and that is not hyperbole. It put the American people at risk.
Now, the Attorney General has now recused himself from the investigation, which has now gone forward because he says he's already been interviewed by the FBI. And I do want to also mention that a number of media outlets, including this one, NPR, has sent a letter of protest to the Justice Department saying that this was overreaching. So, Corey, I'm going to start with you because this is the administration in which you served. Do you think that the Department of Justice was wrong?
Well, I'll tell you, this is the classic conversation, a classic battle between the American people's right to know, which is the role of the press, the role of the media in our country, versus the government's responsibility to protect its citizens. And right now, I think we're at the very beginning of this conversation and investigating what actually happened here and why it happened. One of the things that was interesting about what the Attorney General said yesterday is that lives were at stake. There was an intonation that the reason they made the decision to pull these records and to try to identify the leaker through this method is because lives were at stake. I think, would be a credible reason to do so. However, there is a process that is in place to make sure that overreaching does not take place. And I think that's what we're concerned about right now.
So what are you saying? You're saying you haven't decided yet. You still don't know in Europe? You still don't know?
I don't know, and I don't think anyone else knows. I think an independent investigation of this issue needs to take place to find out what was the mitigating circumstances under why the decision was made. And I think ultimately it's going to come down to, was there an imminent threat?
Well, the AP says that they believe that a story about a failed Al-Qaeda bomb plot in Yemen triggered this search for these phone records. There has been speculation from a number of media outlets, including the New York Times and the Atlantic, that the story might have blown the cover of a double agent who'd infiltrated Al-Qaeda. If that's true, do you think the Attorney General has a point?
No, I don't. Absolutely, I don't. I believe that the First Amendment is in place for a reason, and I worry about the chilling effect that this will have to abridge the right of reporters to be able to have their sources, to be able to track down the leads that they were doing with their stories. If the Justice Department was so worried in this particular case about our national security interests, I find it very interesting that during the Bush administration, President Bush actually called the publisher of the New York Times into the Oval Office and said, for national security reasons, we don't want you to leak this sensitive information because it could put Americans at risk, and the Times ran it. So if it wasn't good enough for us in the Times case for us to have had that secrecy that we wanted, it's not good enough for the Obama administration to skirt around, I believe, the First Amendment.
Corey, does he have a point?
Well, we have to appreciate the circumstances under which the decisions were made. Before that story ran, the Justice Department asked the AP to hold it for national security purposes, which they did. Once the AP felt that the story no longer had an impression on national security, then they ran the story. The concern is the leaker. And I agree with Ron that the challenge here is that whenever you have a government organization reaching into and having an impact on one of our founding institutions, such as the press, and stepping on potentially the First Amendment, which is there for a reason, to make sure that the American people have insight into what's happening in their government, that's where you have a problem, and that's where the question comes.
Well, before we move on to our other subject, though, I mean, you would not deny, would you, that there have been some very tense relationships between this administration and the media? I mean, it's ironic, given that many people on the Republican side believe that the media is too close to the Obama administration, but in fact, would you confirm that there have been some very tense interactions between your former administration and the media?
I would say that there's been no more tense notions with this administration than any previous one. I mean, if you look at what happened during the Bush administration, when you look at what happened during the Clinton administration, during the Carter administration, I think there is always that tension. I think that's generally a healthy tension because you don't want the two organizations to be too close. But at the same time, there needs to be mutual respect and understanding for the role that each entity plays. And right now, there may have been some overreaching. I think it's yet to be determined.
We want to talk to the other big story that people are talking about this week, reports. The reports broke out late last week that the IRS was taking a closer look at groups that were applying for nonprofit status if they had words like Tea Party or Patriot in their names. And I want to ask, Corey, I'll go to you again on this. Do you think that the administration overstepped its bounds here?
I think the IRS overstepped its bounds. I would not be as expansive as to say the administration overstepped their bounds. And here's what we know at this point. The IG report has come out. There's been an apology from the office that conducted this investigation in the way that they did, or this survey in the way that they did. And ultimately, we now have two very strong statements from the president, as you said in the opening, that called this outrageous and has now called on Secretary Liu to stand up and make sure that a proper investigation is conducted and whomever is responsible for putting this act into place takes responsibility and I assume ultimately will be fired.
Well, Ron, you know, the question becomes, I'm still sort of interested in, I'm not quite sure who the primary actors were in this and whether this was directed by political partisans with the intention of harassing people who are perceived to be political opponents if they were career persons. I mean, now it turns out that, you know, House Speaker John Boehner has already publicly speculated about who should go to jail here. And I want to ask you if you think that's appropriate.
I'm not going to speculate as to who should go to jail, but the one thing I won't speculate about is whose responsibility this is. This is the Obama administration. You know, the president was out the other day saying that this is an independent agency. Well, no, sir, actually it's not. The head of the IRS is a political appointee who reports to the Secretary of the Treasury, who is a political appointee, both of whom are in the Obama administration. I do not understand. I think this is one of the most...
Well, you know, it's in the FBI. For example, the FBI director is an independent agency who's appointed by a political figure who transcends administrations. I mean, that's a similar...
No. What we're talking about here ultimately is responsible. It is the responsibility of two Obama appointees who oversee the IRS to make sure that this sort of chicanery doesn't take place. It did. Now, the question...
So what should happen? That's...
Well,
what
first of all, I don't understand this president. This president is walking and sitting and being so passive. I would be a lot more hands-on. First of all, I would have apologized to the American people. Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury, hasn't apologized to the American people. This is an egregious, in my view, breach of trust. They're standing by, well, let's just wait for the investigation. Let's see where it goes. No. You need to set up the framework, Mr. President. You need to say what this framework is, how you're going to hold people accountable and responsible for this, and outline to the American people when you expect this to be done. That's why I'm angry with this. I am so beyond livid that the fact that the president seems to be standing by, oh, well, folks will get back to me, and, oh, I heard about this in the newspaper.
Well, Koreans, does he have a point? I mean, the fact is that there are people who are kind of raising analogies to the Nixon administration where we know that tax audits or abusive or aggressive auditing was targeted at people who are perceived to be political opponents of that president, and a lot of those people were journalists, so they were progressives.
One very quick point of clarification here. There is no evidence that this president had any role in directing this IRS to conduct the investigation in the way that they did. So I think comparing what's happening here to what happened with Watergate, I think is dramatic overreach.
Okay, but what about Ron's point that the president needs to be more vocal about this?
Well, I don't know how much more vocal you can get. He's issued two statements saying how outrageous this is. He's called for his Secretary of the Treasury to make sure that a full investigation is conducted, and the Justice Department has launched their own investigation. So this is this is much more open and shut to me as far as how it's being handled, the speed with which it's being handled, and the veracity with which it's being handled. I think they're moving in the right direction on this IRS issue, and appreciate what we're talking about here. The IRS is the big monster sitting in the room waiting for you to mess up. Everybody's afraid of the IRS, right? So the fact that they would reach into and overstep their bounds by targeting conservative organizations, and it doesn't matter—
For special scrutiny,
absolutely, is absolutely unconscionable when you appreciate the amount of power they have and the impact they have on the American people's
lives.
But
before we let you go, I really have to ask, and I apologize, Ron, you got cheated in this conversation, but Corey, this, again, do you think that this puts the president's second-term agenda at risk? Because there is so much anger now directed at the administration because of this conduct. Do you think it puts the rest of the term at risk in terms of accomplishing anything?
No. First of all, we have to be realistic about where we are. First of all, there is more to come in each of these conversations with the IRS and with the DOJ AP issue. What the White House needs to do is to deal with them rapidly and succinctly and move past them. And they need to do so as rapidly as possible. Right now, the challenge they're having is wrapping their hands around the fact that they're dealing with all of these big issues at one time. And that is a challenge for this White House or any White House. I think so. Ultimately, I think they're going to be fine, but they really do need to get in front of this and move on quickly.
That was Corey Elams. He's a senior vice president for Vox Global and a former director of media for the Obama administration. He was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Republican strategist, former assistant to President George W. Bush, Ron Christie. He's now the president of Christie Strategies. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up after a disaster, naturally grown-ups are worried about things like food and shelter, but kids still need to have fun. We'll speak with a man who's trying to help kids in distress do just that by making sure they can still play baseball. We'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. But first, it's time for our beauty shop conversation. That's where we get a fresh cut on hot topics with a panel of women journalists, commentators, bloggers, and activists. This week, we are talking about the very serious topic of sexual assault in the military. Just yesterday, the Army announced that a soldier who coordinated the sexual assault prevention program at Fort Hood is under investigation for, of all things, abusive sexual contact of subordinates. That came a week after the Department of Defense released numbers on sexual assaults in the military. The numbers are high. Some 26,000 such assaults were reported by service members. That number is up dramatically from where they were just a year ago. We wanted to talk more about this problem and why it persists and what could be done about it. So we are joined by a group of women who've thought very deeply about this issue. And this is probably a good time to mention that this subject might not be suitable for everybody. So with that being said, Anup Bhagwati is the executive director of the Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. She's also a retired Marine officer. Amy Ziering is one of the producers behind the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Invisible War, which is about sexual assault in the armed services. Also with us, Bridget Johnson. She's the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian commentary and news website. And she also covers the Pentagon. So thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Michelle.
So, Anu, let me start with you. The report from the Pentagon estimates that, and this was self-reporting, okay, that 26,000 people in the armed forces say that they were sexually assaulted in 2012. 2 years ago, that number was 19,000. But these individuals also said that very few of them had gone through the process of formally reporting this. And I want to ask you, first of all, what you make of the numbers. Are you surprised by this number? And why is it that so few of these reports have made its way into kind of formal charges?
Well, thanks for having me, Michelle. I think the first thing to realize is that those 26,000 service members anonymously stated that they had been sexually assaulted. In other words, they did not officially report. Very few service members actually officially reported through the chain of command. And so We have an enormous situation of underreporting within the military. Underreporting is even worse within the military. Service members also reported that, and well over 60%, that they fear reporting because of intimidation, because of the culture within the military that discourages support for victims, that encourages victim blaming, that is filled with rape mythology. And so a part of the problem is the folks that you're reporting to are or ultimately the commanding officers who are actually making legal decisions about whether or not criminal cases go forward to trial, those folks, those senior officers, senior enlisted leaders, are all completely ingrained in military culture, which right now is backwards. It is a couple of generations behind the times in terms of understanding victim blaming and understanding that, you know, victims are not responsible for being raped. It should be the perpetrators that are held accountable.
Amy Ziering, I want to bring you into this conversation because you spoke with a number of women who had had this experience for your documentary, The Invisible War. I just want to play a clip of one of the women, Tia Christopher. She was in the United States Navy. She talked about the reaction she got when she tried to report that she had been raped. Let's listen.
They took me before my lieutenant commander. He says, "Do you think this is funny?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Is this all a joke to you?" I was like, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "You're the third girl to report rape this week. Are you guys like all in cahoots? You think this is a game?"
Amy, based on the conversations you had, was this a common experience?
It was all too common. It was really shocking and astonishing to me talking to these men and women over and over again, just repeated the same story, is that the second they reported in good faith, believing that they would be heard, believed, understood, and justice would actions to, you know, go after the perpetrators would be taken time and again. Instead, they were disbelieved, they were challenged, they were scoffed at, they were mocked. And they were just told to sort of return to work or suck it up and, you know, act like nothing happened. And that was pretty, pretty shocking. And that was not an anomalous situation. That more was the norm rather than the exception.
Bridget Johnson, talk to me about this. What is your perception of how the leadership in the Pentagon views this issue? Because we've been hearing over the years, I mean, I confess I have been reporting on the subject for 10 years now, and the story never seems to change. You have leaders in the Pentagon, the top leaders talk about this. I've personally attended like training sessions at Quantico where commanders have talked about the importance of this, the importance of dignity, the importance of fairness, and yet you continue to hear stories like this. What do you make of this?
Right, and I do think that's unfortunate because I think that this is a solution that needs to come from within and not, you know, necessarily from Congress on high. But I do have some concerns about the earliest days of Chuck Hagel. You know, I think that this coming out of transition time from Panetta to Hagel is not the best thing, and it wasn't the best thing for sequestration either. You know, I really feel that Hagel's kind of over his head right now with
furloughs. But I'm asking you a different question. I get your point on this, but I'm still interested in your perception of how this is viewed within the command structure of the Pentagon based on your reporting here.
So. That they have many things to juggle at the moment. That's how it feels. And so they're trying to juggle cuts. They're trying to juggle, you know, different defense challenges at the moment. And I think that they kind of feel like this is one more thing on the plate. Not that it doesn't have importance, but it may not have the precedence that it should have.
Well, and why do you have particular concerns about Chuck Hagel, the current defense secretary?
I've just seen, you know, he's kind of over his head and getting used to the role, I think, right now. And you can see at press conferences, et cetera, you know, he gets fielded a lot of standard questions and he kind of shifts them over to General Dempsey. So when you're getting used to this role and so much is happening at this moment, you can see, you know, why somebody would be over their head on this.
Anu Bugwadi, what is your take on this and why this situation never seems to change? And I hope I'm not overstating the case, but just based on my own reporting on this issue over the years, I just feel like it's the same storyline over and over, that egregious things occur, and it seems to be, the focus seems to be on the targets of the behavior, the victims, and as opposed to the perpetrators and getting a handle on that conduct. What's your perception of why this problem persists?
Well, the problem persists because very little has changed within the military. And I would strongly disagree with the other guest that the solution should come from within. The solution absolutely cannot come from within. And that's entirely why this problem persists, is because for the past several decades, Congress and the courts and the White House have consistently deferred back to the military to fix this problem. And it has been, you know, at this point when military deference is sort of given to the military, I think there's a little bit of good faith that, you know, maybe there are some senior military leaders that can, that really care about this issue. But I mean, it, you know, the first 50 years of this crisis, you know, it was really a joke the way these crimes were committed and the care that victims were given. But the solution lies in criminal justice reform, in making the military justice system at least on par with the civilian justice system. And we know how broken the civilian justice system is for, in terms of sex crimes and providing justice for victims. But the military lags behind even the civilian system. So it's still your boss or your boss's boss determining whether or not your case goes forward. And it's completely biased institutionally. I mean, how is it that it sort of something that should lie in HR, right, becomes part of a criminal adjudication? It makes no sense. Commanding officers they are not lawyers. They are not judges, and yet they're endowed with the authority of lawyers and judges in the civilian world.
You know what's interesting, Amy? I just want to point about your film, The Invisible War, also interviews men who have talked about being sexually assaulted. It is interesting that a lot of people kind of attribute this problem to the fact that women are such a hyper-minority within the military. They're what Richard helped me here is like 11% of active duty service members. But you also interviewed a number of men who have been sexually assaulted. I just want to play a short clip of an interview you did with Michael Matthews. He was in the Air Force, and he talked about what happened to him when he was 19.
I went to the chow hall alone, and the next thing I know, I was laying on the ground. I was struck from behind. And two guys were holding me down, and one guy was pulling my pants down. And, you know, he was taking care of his business. And, you know, I struggled, and I was being struck and hit and told to shut up or they'd kill me.
So, Amy, you know, this is the kind of thing you hear about in prison, right? So what is the – did you ever detect a through line in why – certain people were targeted? Like, what was the point of this? I mean, you can see where in certain control environments you say, well, this is about dominance, or this is about establishing a hierarchy or something. Did you ever notice any kind of through line or any theme to why it is that certain people are targeted, why these assaults take place, any certain situations in which they tend to take place?
Yeah, these are not random acts. I mean, these take place because there are serial predators that are really cunning and skilled and know how to work a system. And the system is one in which they're not going to get prosecuted. So that's the problem. Is the military has an embedded serial predator problem, and they're not brought. There's no repercussions for their actions. So that's why this crime is proliferating at these epidemic levels within the military. It's not a surprise. And yes, it's equal opportunity offender. It's gender neutral. Men and women are assaulted at pretty much the same rates. So it's something that the military, as Anu was saying, it really actually needs to take care of, can take care of, and needs to stop, you know, covering up and acting like it's a problem that's just going to go away.
Anu, let's talk in the time that we have left about the solutions that various people have brought forward. And Bridget, obviously, I'm going to hear from you as well on this. I mean, we know that members of Congress like Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Senator Barbara Boxer of California are set to introduce legislation on Thursday that would remove major criminal cases from the chain of command. Do you think that that's a good idea? And what other things do you believe should happen?
Senator Gillibrand has been really a leader in the last few months on this issue, and we've been working closely with her on the legislation to be introduced tomorrow. So we know its content. And yes, absolutely, it would fix the problem in terms of bias in the criminal justice system. And that's a huge factor in terms of victims' confidence in the culture, victims' confidence reporting, right? So we want more of those 26,000. I mean, first of all, we don't want any service members to be raped or assaulted. But if they are, we want more of those victims to come forward and report, and we want to have a sense that the military criminal justice system isn't institutionally biased. And so this bill would remove that bias by making sure it's not commanding officers that have what's called convening authority. They're not the ones determining if cases go forward or what happens in terms of jury selection or judge selection, or, you know, even given the authority to reverse a criminal conviction, which is what commanding officers currently can do in criminal cases, but it's actually attorneys and judges. In other words, impartial legally trained experts who are in charge of that whole process.
Bridget, what about you? You were saying you think that the problem, that the solution needs to come from within. What would that right. look like?
Well, when I was talking about change coming from within, I'm talking more of a cultural change, and that's really hard to dictate from the outside. You know, when you're standing there in Congress and saying, you guys need to end your good old boys, you know, attitude over there. You know, I think that this is a situation where people not only want to see swift and appropriate justice, but they want to see consistency. Are allegations treated with proper care? Are punishments consistent? Are they able to be upended easily if the superior officer happens to really like that person who was accused? So I think that you know, change can be successful and lasting coming from within, but you need to have the right people in those, obviously, as we've seen, in those roles of overseeing sexual abuse cases, maybe somebody who's been in JAG, you know, maybe somebody who's, you know, already had extensive work with this instead of just, you know, as in the case of the Arlington guy who was arrested, just kind of oversaw that unit at one time or another.
Well, just what Bridget's referring to here is that just this past weekend, an Air Force officer who oversaw sexual abuse training was himself arrested for groping a woman, a civilian woman, in a parking lot who was right. able to defend herself and called the police. But, yeah, Bridget, I have to ask you about the cultural problem. I mean, I have to say that there are those who will be listening to our conversation and will say that this is just further proof that women don't belong in the military. They certainly don't belong in combat. And I want to know whether the people within the military, is that really kind of the part of the bottom line? They still just don't believe that women belong there.
I would honestly say, yes, there are some people who feel that way. I've seen people try and use that as an excuse for women not being in combat roles, that, you know, it would just open this up more. That's completely the wrong approach to take.
If I can jump in, it's
sure.
Amy.
Amy, sure.
As the clip you played showed, it's not a man against woman crime. It's a crime against both men and women. So it actually doesn't have to do with women being in the military or not.
But there are right. those who certainly feel that way. I mean, you just know that there are certain people who believe that this is it's the part of the issue here is that the presence of women is just somehow so provocative that's
yeah. But that you can just point out that's a fallacy because statistically men are raped at a slightly larger rate than women in the military. So it's not a crime against women, particularly.
Amy, before we let you go, we know that you've kept in touch with a number of the people you interviewed for the Invisible War, and I'm interested if whether they believe that change is coming, whether there are plans being made that would make it better for the next generation of service members.
I can't speak on their behalf. I mean, I know that all of us are sort of quietly optimistic that at least something has changed and that this can't go, we can't go backwards. You know, hopefully we'll go forwards, but certainly this is no longer a secret. People know this is a problem, and let's hope we get the right pressures to adjust, you know, to make a difference. I mean, Senator Gillibrand's been remarkable, and we're hopeful that this legislation will pass, but I'm also really waiting for and hopeful that someone from within the military, high ranking, will come out and speak loudly on this issue and champion it and take it on. And that's sort of been disappointing to me. Where are the military leaders right now expressing outrage? It shouldn't be me, Anu, and you all talking about it on every news show every other day. I want to see, you know, military leadership stepping up along with Senator Gillibrand and saying, look, this is a problem. It needs to be addressed and we can address it and we want to. I mean, where is that?
Anu Bhagwati, final thought from you. You're the executive director of the Service Women's Action Network. Presumably, you are still in touch with many women in the service, as well as retirees like yourself. What's your sense of it? Do you think something's going to change?
Well, I think we've reached a tipping point in terms of national attention to this issue, and much of that is due to the media attention and congressional attention and the Invisible War being broadcast to millions of people who had no idea that this was going on. But I would add to what Amy said by saying the Commander-in-Chief needs to be the leader here. It's the Joint Chiefs and the Commander-in-Chief who need to pressure both sides of the aisle. This should be a nonpartisan issue. This should be a non-gendered issue. This is about all of our men and all of our women being safe to serve when they volunteer to serve in uniform, period.
And if I can jump in and say
I'm
yes.
sorry, Amy, we don't have time. I'm sorry, forgive me. This is the final word that had to be the final word. Anu Bhagwati is the executive director of the Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. She's a retired Marine officer, and she was with us from our bureau in New York. Amy Ziering is one of the producers behind the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Invisible War, which is about this issue. She joined us from our studios at NPR West in Culver City, California, here in Washington, D.C. Bridget Johnson, Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media, a conservative libertarian commentary and news website. She's also covered the Pentagon for many years. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, I have some thoughts on redemption, who gets it and who doesn't. That's my Can I Just Tell You essay, and that's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to tell you about somebody who's come up with an interesting way to help kids. Spring is here, and for a lot of us, that means grabbing a chair and heading to the park and taking in a game or two at the local field. So what do you do if for some reason you don't have enough equipment or not enough for a whole team? That's where David Rode comes in. He founded the organization Pitch In for Baseball. It collects gently used equipment so that kids all over the U.S. and around the world can play ball. And David Rode is with us now from Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure, Michelle. Great to be here.
Also with us is Stella Smith. She is a softball player from Island Park, New York. Her family just moved back home after having to leave their home in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, and we're pleased that she's with us as well. Stella, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You know, they say you shouldn't tell a lady's age, so is it okay if I say that you're 12?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you hear that I had her permission to share that. So David wrote, let me start with you. How did you get the idea for Pitch In for Baseball?
Well, it was 2005. I had recently sold a business. I was looking to do something that made a bigger impact in the world. And at the same time, I was coaching my two boys in baseball. And looking around, I could see that the stuff that was piling up in my house and in my garage, if it was anything like other folks around the country, then there was a lot of gear that could be put to better use. And so, in effect, that was the genesis of Pitch In for Baseball right there. If we could connect people with stuff, with folks that needed it, we could make a difference.
So 2005 is the same year as Hurricane Katrina. Were the two related?
Sure. It was happenstance. The organization was founded during the summer, but our first organizational meeting was September 20th of that year, about 3 weeks after Hurricane Katrina. So even though the original focus of the organization was meant to be helping kids overseas play the game, it seemed that there was so much energy and so much desire to help kids here in the United States that our focus went to the Gulf Coast region, and that's where most of our first donations took place.
I want to hear that in a minute, too, but I do want to get to Stella. So Stella, how long have you been playing softball?
I've been playing softball since I was 7, but I also played t-ball when I was like 4 or 5 years old.
And so when Hurricane Sandy hit, I know that had to have been hard and scary. Where were you staying? I know you couldn't stay in your house, so what did you do?
Well, for the first 2 weeks, we stayed with my aunt in Massapequa, and then we found a basement that we could stay in with my dad's friend's wife and her two children. So we stayed there until just the past month or so when we moved back in.
Wow. And what happened to all your stuff?
Well, actually, all my stuff is upstairs, so I got to save most of it. But my brother and my mom and my dad lost everything, so I knew I had to stay strong and be supportive of them. So.
But it wasn't this. Yeah, that is hard. But what does it mean to you to be back playing with your team? Is it a time when you can kind of put all the bad stuff away?
It is, because it feels like nothing can go wrong. My feelings can't get hurt, and because everyone's included, and it just, everyone is so great, and I just love my whole team.
Well, David, what about that? I mean, you can imagine where some people are saying, after an emergency or after something goes wrong, what kids really need is food, shelter, you know, in a place to go to school. What do you say to that?
We agree 100% that, you know, baseball has to have its right place. And certainly in our situation, we've been involved with natural disasters, not by choice, but because people contact us and ask for assistance. So our first priority business is making sure all of those humanitarian needs are met. But what we've experienced first in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina and all the way through Hurricane Sandy is it's very difficult and sometimes non-existent for these sort of quality of life extracurricular activities, because communities and families sometimes have to prioritize, and kids are asked to sacrifice in a lot of situations. And we really don't think that that's fair. And after a storm or after some other event, your life is turned upside down. And sometimes for kids, the kids that we've met, the most important thing on their mind is really, you know, what about my game on Tuesday, or what about my glove? And so we think it's great to give kids just that simple activity, the simple sense of joy of going out and playing.
I understand that initially you thought that your efforts would mainly go to places that are already baseball crazy, like the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico. But I understand that you find out that that's actually not the case.
Yeah, so we've found that some of the greatest needs and some of the greatest interest in pitching for baseball and in playing baseball is from folks that are in Africa or folks that are in Eastern Europe, places that are just discovering baseball or playing for the first time. So from our perspective, playing a role in that for us is a tremendous privilege, and we love seeing the pictures and the videos and hearing the stories of kids playing in a particular area for the very first time.
How many countries have you served so far, do you think?
It's just north of 75 countries.
75 countries?
Yes.
Wow. I know that you have to make sure that the teams actually have a place to play, but do you also make sure that they have somebody to play against?
Well, I mean, ultimately, in many situations, it's a league or it's a program, so there may be 4, 6, 8 teams that are starting at a given point in time, or we do want to understand that, so it could be a school-based program where we're helping a given team at a school, but there are 6 schools in their community, for lack of a better term, that that they'll be playing against. So we just want to learn about them, understand their story, and make sure it's going to fit in, but in some situations, it's as simple as a teacher at a school or a teacher in a town or a coach in a town that wants to teach baseball, and playing competitive games isn't the first thing on their mind. It's really giving a kid's exposure to the game.
And what about someplace close to home, like in the New York area, the northeastern area that was affected by Hurricane Sandy? Would you just automatically know where the teams are that are probably washed out?
Well, we have a number of wonderful strategic partners. We work very closely with the folks at Little League International. We work with Babe Ruth Baseball and other sort of national organizations. So if a league that lost something would contact the home office, if you were, so Little League in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, they would refer them to us. In other situations, it simply is word of mouth. And there are folks that will just search online and they'll want to find out how they might be able to get equipment. So they'll do any kind of a search, and we come up number one or number two in any kind of an internet search for making a donation of baseball equipment.
And Stella, when did you play your first game? You've played your first game already, right?
We played it a couple weeks ago, and it was against Long Beach.
Do you want to tell me how you did?
We did good for our first game. The score was 7-1 for a while, and we made a comeback and ended it with 7-6.
Hey, that's respectable. What was it like to get out there for the first time after not having been able to get together with all your friends for so long?
It felt amazing because I actually felt like I could be part of a team and call myself part of a team.
And Stella, before we let you go, is there something you could, if you wouldn't mind, from your perspective, could you tell us why it's so important to be able to play and have adults like David try to help to make sure that kids can play?
It's really important in my point of view because we need our friends, and as much as we need food and gas and all the things that adults have to worry about, kids worry about it too. And, like, I know it doesn't seem like that, but we do. And the most important thing to us is if our families are okay, and just being back on the field makes us feel like we don't need to worry about that anymore.
So, Stella, what's the name of your team?
It's just Island Park Little League Softball. We're sponsored by Nassau Federal Financial Credit Union and jewelry by Stevens.com.
Yes, ma'am. I was going to say, what do I say? Go Island Park?
Yeah.
All right. Good luck with the rest of the season. Go Island Park. Stella Smith is a softball player. She's 12 years old, and she, as she told you, is from Island Park, New York. She plays for Island Park Little League there. She was kind enough to join us from home. And David Rode is also with us. He's the executive director of Pitch In for Baseball. That is a nonprofit that takes donations of gently used and new equipment and provides it to teams around the world. And he was kind enough to join us from Philadelphia. David Rode, thank you so much for joining us. Stella Smith, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, our colleagues at the NPR program Weekends on All Things Considered have been asking some of their guests, particularly people in the film business, about the movies that they never get tired of watching. Today we hear from actress Regina King. Her credits include Jerry Maguire and Ray. She currently stars on the TNT television show Southland. The movie she could watch a million times is The Sandlot.
I'm Regina King, actress and aspiring director. And the movie I've watched a million times is The Sandlot, directed by Dave Evans. And starring Patrick Renna, Tom Geary, and Dennis Leary. The movie is about a kid named Smalls who moves into the neighborhood with his mother and stepdad. And he befriends this group of kids that play baseball in the sandlot.
You never heard of Salted a Swat?
The Titan of Terror.
Colossus of Clout?
The Colossus of Clout.
Oh, yeah, the Great Bambino.
Of course.
I thought you said the Great Bambi.
That wimpy deer?
All the personalities of these boys were so different, and it reminded me of my block growing up.
Hey, you want a s'more?
S'more what?
No, you want a s'more.
I haven't had anything yet, so how can I have some more of nothing?
You're killing me, Smalls.
The sandlot that they play in, it's right next to James Earl Jones' house. And he has this huge dog that they call the Beast.
Because when Mr. Myrtle asked the cops how long he had to keep the Beast chained up like a slave, they said until forever. Forever.
Smalls doesn't really know much about baseball. He's learning as he's with them. And the whole time that they are talking about the greatest player ever, they're talking about Babe Ruth, but they never say his name. So a ball goes over the fence, and they're like, okay, playtime is over. And Smalls is like, well, I got a ball.
I got it, guys! I got it! I got the ball, guys! I got it!
Little does he know, he goes and gets the ball that his stepdad had signed by Babe Ruth for them to play with. It's his first home run, and he hits it over the fence. And they're like, oh, man, Smalls, okay, playtime is over again. And he's like, no, I got to get that ball back, guys.
You got to get that ball back.
Oh, yeah, right. Good one, Smalls. Oh, yeah, good one, Smalls.
No, you don't understand.
You don't understand. I got to get that ball back. It's my dad's ball. And they're like, why is this such a big deal? And he says, I don't know. It was signed by some girl. And they're like, some girl? Who?
Some lady named Ruth. Baby Ruth.
Babe Ruth!
Ah! That scene is also my son's favorite scene. I showed that movie to my son when he was about 5 years old. I tell you, this kid watched it like he had it on a loop. And still to this day, certain things will happen. And my son, he's 16 now, will say something like, listen to me, Smalls, you know. It still has such a connection for me and my son 11 years later.
That's Regina King talking about the movie she could watch a million times, The Sandlot. She currently stars on the television show Southland. Finally today, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford just won back his old congressional seat in the same week that unsavory facts about Cleveland rescuer Charles Ramsey came to light. Ramsey, of course, is the man who helped rescue three women who'd been held hostage for a decade. It turns out that he'd done time in prison a decade ago for beating up his former wife, and the reason he happened to be home that fateful day is that he'd been suspended from his job. The issue in Sanford's past is that he finished out his term as governor, but became the punchline of comedians around the country after he cooked up an elaborate story about hiking in the woods to cover up his affair with an Argentine woman. Yes, I know, you don't have to tell me. Beating your wife is a whole different thing than stepping out on her and lying about it. Even though, once in future, Congressman Sanford voted to impeach another politician for essentially doing the same thing, stepping out on his wife and lying about it. And yes, I know, you don't have to tell me about the importance of forgiveness and redemption. Still, can I just tell you, I just think it's worth pointing out how much more perfect poor people have to be to win and keep the respect of the country than the well-off ever have to be, and how much harder that forgiveness and redemption seems to be to come by. Case in point, two stories side by side in the business section of the New York Times on Sunday. On the left side, Gretchen Morgenson's column about the failures of the directors of some high-profile public companies, like recruiting the wrong executives, overpaying them with no regard for performance, and failing to manage or even monitor foreseeable risks, all of which have had devastating consequences in recent years for outside shareholders, not to mention employees. But when's the last time one of these directors or executives paid any real price for their failures? Are they blacklisted in their chosen fields? Are they kept from working at all? I don't think so. Let's turn to the right side of the business section, where we find a profile of a man named Alfred Carpenter, who can't get a job in his field selling high-priced shoes because of his poor credit. Credit that suffered because he was laid off from a previous job, then got hurt at a time when he didn't have insurance. And the piece goes on to say that Carpenter is not alone. In 2012, half of businesses surveyed by a Human Resource Association reported using credit checks as a pre-employment tool. The piece says that the credit reporting agencies say credit history is a measure of a person's integrity and responsibility. But increasingly, critics of this practice say all it really is a measure of whether people have money, or I might add, families to bail them out. I think of all the people who've written to us in recent years who are also being squeezed, not just by lack of money, but by lack of time. I still remember the letter I got last year after we did a series on elder care from a man who said he was so busy taking care of two frail and elderly relatives, trying to keep them not just safe, but financially afloat, that his own financial planning had fallen by the wayside. Surely, knowing what we know about how the country is aging and how little many seniors have managed to put away in savings, he's not alone. My point is not to excuse carelessness or profligacy, but simply to point out that some people are paying a very high price for a bad decision or a stretch of bad luck in their lives, being in an industry where work has dried up, buying a house in an area that's been overbuilt, maybe even having a drinking problem, and they have to hear lectures about their integrity and the moral hazards of helping them, which rarely happens, while other people lie, cheat, or just fail. And what price did they pay, except for earlier than planned retirement to some pleasant beach house somewhere? Back to Mr. Ramsey. So now we know he did some bad things. He's not perfect. Let's see whether he finds the redemption that's been so readily offered to some of our posher citizens who've not done nearly as much as he did in an afternoon to change someone's life for the better. And while we're at it, maybe we could think about a little taste of forgiveness for some of the other people in this country who aren't perfect, but are trying. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.